Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rick Martin, pro se. I'm one of 200,000 foreclosed Colorado citizens, so I'm here with 200,000 souls. There's another 200,000 waiting to be foreclosed in the state of Colorado. I have 7 quick issues I'm going to try to point to in 15 minutes. The key issue is whether the 3840-105B Bank Lender Fraud Act has any teeth whatsoever. Did the Colorado Congress meant to give a balancing to the every home equity loan has, of course, a collection fee for the borrower to face not only losing their home, but paying attorney fees if there's a collection issue on a foreclosed house. Now, the balancing to that is a lender law. The lender law, 105B, gives triple damages and attorney fees to the borrower if the bank has committed a fraud. That is a case of first impression for this court. No one has ever stood up to a bank and said the bank's fraud. Here's the statute. It's a strict liability statute. If the bank solicits using false facts, and they knew or should have known the facts were false, like my appraisal was 33% high, then I get triple damages and attorney fees in a jury trial. So that's the key issue. The other 6 follow along. The Recording Act, the Wild Deed Act, says if the bank knew or should have known that 2.5 years earlier I put my home in a trust account, and they had that trust in their left hand, in fact, their documents cite to it, in fact, the bank adjoins my building for 10 years. Every person in the bank and I knew each other very well. We shared the parking lot. In fact, it was a question whether their sprinkler system and my building were sharing the same water for a few months. I had a $50,000 signature line of credit. My 95-year-old mother's personal account was there in joint with me, $60,000 a month in legal revenue after 15 years of building my practice, went through the bank. My personal account was there. Most of my cash life savings were there. Essentially, I walked in and got a $250,000 loan in 3 days. And signed a bunch of papers. And nobody in the bank or myself ever envisioned Katrina, the housing bubble, and the economic 10% unemployment, and my practice earning me this year less than $30,000, which was not the situation in 2005. And so the Wild Deed says the bank certainly should have known that when they filed this deed, that since they held the trust in their one hand, cited to it in those documents, they knew or should have known that the papers they filed and recorded were false, and that I didn't own the house, the trust owned the house. And 10 years earlier, another statute said that trusts can own real estate. Prior to 10 years ago, as you know, there was a gray area of whether a trust could own real estate. That was...
Mr. Martin, let me ask you a question about the intent behind the reformation. Since the home was owned by the trust, you really had no authority as an individual to encumber the property, only as trustee, correct?
Correct.
And so what other intent could there have been to sign except as trustee?
Remember, when I signed 25 times, I gave my cash flow as a law firm, my mother's life savings, my checking account, my mother's checking account. Oh, and by the way, we'll never take your house. There's something here about an appraisal. That too. So the young banker made a commission and quit the bank. My belief is that had he made the paperwork proper, as he had when he mortgaged my building next door a year earlier, and all those trust documents are in my complaint, that it would have taken months. Maybe he couldn't have quit, made his commission and run. But his intent, I think, was to make a quick kill, slide it through as an individual. And did I pick up that I was signing improperly? No. I found that out when I went to sue the bank. And that's the second reason I sued the bank, or stopped paying and they sued me. Because A, the appraisal was 33% off. RE/MAX appraiser said that, did a complete appraisal, that's on the record. And secondly, the paperwork was all wrong. And they knew or should have known. And yes, the warranty that I warranted that I would come in power to encumber the property was signed. And if we were in a 3-year statute of limitations, if the bank went in such a hurry to destroy the economy with their throwing out money and sloppy paperwork, they would have brought me in on the warranty deed and done a reformation, pardon me, of the paperwork. I should have brought water. Within the 3-year statute, they didn't. They have no warranty deed cause of action to come back at me and enforce that. It's way past that. So, did I answer your question?
I'm not sure you did. Did you put into the record an affidavit stating exactly what your intent was with respect to the, to signing in your individual capacity a deed of trust that purported to own the trust's, purported to encumber the trust's property?
I put in my complaint and in the record that the banker's intent was to get me $250,000 in 3 days.
Sure.
And not take my house.
What was your intent when you signed a deed of trust that describes trust property, but you signed it as an individual?
Frank, what was my intent at the moment of signature?
Yes.
It was my intent to encumber my entire law firm and my mother's life savings and mine to the bank. And there was no question I would ever pay this, because the bank and the boat started as a healthy charter boat. I didn't dig through an inch of paperwork. The bank didn't even give me a closing document. They didn't give me the appraisal till I sued them. I had no pay. I didn't even keep a copy. I wasn't even given a copy. It was just like my signature loan for $50,000 that for years I had run the bank, through the bank, to run the law firm, up and down, money going to Germany, to Switzerland on patents. It was fairly insignificant transaction.
Let me try. When you signed the deed of trust, what, did you have no intent to encumber the property?
When I signed the deed of, oh, that deed of
trust. It's a yes or no question.
Intent to encumber the property. To encumber the property. The banker loan officer said, sign these papers. Here, 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 we have the right to take your cash flow, your mother's savings, your savings. What about the house? He said, we would never take your house. Sign these papers. You're out of here. Here's the check for the boat. On the record, the bank wrote the check to the boat yard.
So the answer to my question is that you did not intend, when you signed the deed of trust, you knew that it would
not. At some point in time, I might have to encumber the house, sir.
When you signed the deed of trust.
He said, you're not really encumbering your house. I relied on him. That is in my complaint.
You understand that the lender statute of frauds precludes us from considering that representation?
Well, the state of mind of two parties, I couldn't even find the loan officer when we were in discovery within weeks of trial. He said he doesn't count, but the reformation, my knowledge is you have to find the intent of two minds. But if you're not going to put the minds in the equation, then how can you even reform a deed as mine was reformed by Judge Balin?
So you saw the deed of trust as simply a sham when you signed it?
A banker's sham, a trick to do.
No, when you signed it, not when the banker signed it, when you signed
it. Sir, created the deed.
No, sir, I'm asking when you signed
it. When I signed, along with 25 other signatures, I thought it was an insignificant way, essentially, to open an office in Florida, that it would be paid. There was no question in my mind, or certainly anyone been with my firm for 10 years, that we couldn't afford to keep paying on that loan. And we did until calamity happened across the board, starting with Katrina, when the charter business disappeared and half the value of the boat disappeared. Boom, and then the economy disappeared. Then my law firm went down to a shrinking survival snail, and I am bankrupt. So I'm part of 200,000 people that say, banks can't get away with a fraud and avoid what the legislature put forward. They're supposed to do honest appraisals. I wouldn't be here if my appraisal was honest. I wouldn't have brought this whole case forward based on the paperwork. But the fraud of the appraisal.
Sir, did you submit an affidavit in the trial court indicating that you would not have entered into the transaction but for the appraisal? which is what you just said.
I wouldn't have entered into this lawsuit but for the appraisal.
No, the transaction. That's what you just said a minute ago, and I'm asking if you put that into an affidavit.
There are no affidavits that I created in this case.
Okay.
Only my complaint and answers to motions to dismiss.
Your interpretation of the bank fraud statute includes that the bank either knew or should have known that the appraisal was fraudulent?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Are there any facts in the record showing that the bank knew or should have known the appraisal was fraudulent?
Yes, there's an attachment showing 8,000 appraisers at that time were marching on the U.S. Senate saying they were forced to commit frauds to elevate the value of homes. You know that.
Okay, and how does that newspaper article create a fact issue as to what this particular bank knew concerning the appraisal of your particular property?
When a swarm of bees is attacking a creature on the ground and you're part of the swarm, U.S. Bank is part of the swarm, this court can take judicial notice as the damage that has happened to the American economy with massive frauds and throwing money on the streets, overvaluing homes. It's public knowledge. If I might read the Wall Street Journal, October
17th. Is that on the record, sir?
No.
Then let's not put it on the record.
Let's not put the Wall Street Journal on the record. My 8,000 appraisers is on the record.
That's in a newspaper article, correct?
It's a summary of a think tank called the Demos Think Tank out of New York City with Kevin Kuttner, renowned economist who was on NPR this morning on the way to court.
That's a piece of paper that was submitted to the lower court?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did you file an affidavit authenticating it?
No, sir.
Okay. Is there anything in that piece of paper that specifically refers to U.S. Bank?
No, sir.
Is there anything in that piece of paper that specifically refers to the house owned by your trust?
No, sir.
Is there anything in the record that specifically connects the bank's knew or should have known to your assertion that the appraisal was fraudulent?
Is there anything in that attachment paper?
Or any other paper that you put before the district court that says this bank knew or should have known that the appraisal on your trust's house?
Yes. Two. There's an expert a report from REMAX, and there's my amateur report showing my own survey of neighborhood homes on my block that were 33% lower or worse across the board. And that information was public. At the time, the bank hired the appraiser and got a false appraisal out of him, and any child could have done their own. Let's look at this block and see the square footage that is the average. And they would have found out that their appraisal was 33% high, as I did 4 years later, and teamed that with the REMAX. They are all on the record. So any amateur, much less a loan officer at a bank in the real estate business, could have surmised that this appraisal was a fraud. But they set it up to throw money on the street, which is why 8,000 appraisers marched on the U.S. Senate trying to avoid the housing bubble, but they failed. And the question is, we have a strict liability statute to try to give, at this point, 200,000 and rising Colorado families, those who have been harmed by a fraud by a massive institution. The public import of banks lending is why the entire 3840-105B exists. It's a strict liability statute. It doesn't say the borrower needs reliance. That word reliance isn't there. That's the key issue for this court to look at. The lower court said, didn't even address, by the way, the statute in the order.
So you said it's common law. In order to be enticed, that means that you were persuaded to do it, right? Isn't that your argument?
Yes, so
you
so, might. Oh, look at my house. That's nice. Well, I know I have $60,000 a month revenue coming in after 15 years of work. I now have all my family savings. Oh, look at that, my house is worth that much too. Hey, this is great. So let's go open a Florida office. The word entice. In fact, remember, it doesn't say I had to rely on it. Absolutely doesn't say that in the statute. This court has to and has the power to define what the intent of the legislature was in creating a Lender Fraud Act. And if you're going to bundle it up with all sorts of pleadings difficulties and what was in the mind of the borrower, and did the borrower act as some kind of honeybee attracted to honey, none of that's in there.
Your time is exhausted, Mr. Martin.
Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Tanya Milligan, attorney registration number 34995, representing U.S. Bank in this appeal. To use Mr. Martin's term, if anyone is bungling things up, it is Mr. Martin, and he continues to do so with this appeal. Mr. Martin has a tendency to talk out of both sides of his mouth, as you can tell from the answers to your questions today. The problem is he wears two hats in this litigation. He represents himself individually. He's a Colorado licensed attorney representing himself. He's also a trustee of the Rick Martin Living Trust, in which he's transferred his personal assets, and as a trustee represents the trust. Problems arise when he goes through life and interacts with others and other parties, and specifically my client, and doesn't clarify which hat he's wearing. Then, when he wishes to avoid his agreements and his statements and actions, he then switches hats. And he's done so throughout this litigation. A short summary of the facts of this case demonstrate the duplicitousness, the duplicity of his arguments here. He creates a personal trust. Martin individual creates the trust, transfers his personal property into the trust, but names himself as trustee and beneficiary, then goes into U.S. Bank, fills out a loan application, and swears under oath or under penalty of perjury that he owns the residence as an individual and not as trustee. Then, in connection with receiving $250,000, signs a deed of trust that declares that he has the authority to sign the deed of trust and has the authority to encumber the property. The deed of trust lists the grantor as Rick Martin. It doesn't say Rick Martin individual, it doesn't say Rick Martin trustee, it's just Rick Martin, who is the trustee of the trust, which is the owner of the property. Neither Rick Martin nor Rick Martin trustee repaid the loan, and so U.S. Bank foreclosed on the property. In order to avoid the foreclosure, he brings a lawsuit against U.S. Bank, claiming, ironically, fraud and other similar claims, and signs various pleadings in the litigation, signs them Rick Martin individual and trustee, and essentially indiscriminately signs documents in the litigation, regardless of which party he's representing. He also, in open court, tells Judge Balin on March 18th, during a hearing, that he is seeking to refinance the property. And the documents demonstrating the refi of the property are signed in his own name, not Rick Martin trustee. Based on his conflicting actions and statements, the district court granted our motion for judgment on the pleadings, and also, just to clarify and make no doubt about the situation, reformed the deed of trust to include Rick Martin individual and Rick Martin trustee.
So let me ask about the reformation. U.S. Bank didn't file a counterclaim, did it?
No, it didn't. It asked for it in the motion. It made the request to the court, and the court has the equitable authority to grant that.
It can do that even when it's not been pled affirmatively?
Yes, it can. It can make those equitable powers under La Plata, the United Bank, 857 P. Second 410. The district court has the authority to fashion equitable remedies when the facts present a basis for an equitable remedy. Mr. Martin, because it was included in our motion, Mr. Martin had full opportunity to respond to that motion and to argue that there was no basis for reformation. The facts, however, come from Rick Martin's own statements. So they exist in the record because the way he presents this situation, there are only one of two options here, and both of which support reformation of this deed of trust. Keep in mind that even if reformation is not upheld, this deed of trust is valid based on Colorado law. Even so, there are two opportunities to reform a document, a contract. One is by when there's evidence of mutual mistake. The other is unilateral mistake coupled with inequitable or fraudulent conduct. And as Mr. Martin presents the facts, either he sat down and signed this document and it was a mutual mistake that the grantor listed Rick Martin and not Rick Martin, comma, trustee, or it was the loan officer's mistake in drafting up the document, and coupled based on Mr. Martin's loan documents stating that under penalty of perjury that he owned the document personally, were there familiarity and him knowing that Rick Martin was the trustee of the trust, and Mr. Martin's failure to change that document or to correct it or to make it more clear. Therefore, there are only two possibilities here for his intent in sitting down and drafting the document, and both of those support reformation.
So, Milligan, I'm changing gears just a little bit. I'd like to ask you about the allegation and the complaint that the appraisal was fraudulently inflated.
Okay.
The bank just takes the appraisal's word for that. There's no duty to do some due diligence and follow up on it?
There may be, Your Honor. The problem with Mr. Morton's fraud / CCPA claim is that he fails to include all of the elements that he needs to allege under that claim. He titles the claim in his complaint as a fraud claim and really doesn't appeal or dispute the fact that he doesn't plead with particularity the elements of a fraud claim. If in that claim he also mentions the statute 3840105, he holds to the grounds that all he has to do is demonstrate a violation of that statute and he somehow has a cause of action. Well, as you well know, not every statute in the Colorado Revised Statute creates a cause of action. Here, 3840105 is only a cause of action under the Colorado Consumer Protection Act, as explicitly stated in the Colorado Consumer Protection Act.
Did you specifically argue to the lower court that the problem with his 3840105B was failure to comply with the CCPA?
The argument we made to the lower court was that he failed to plead the cause of action with particularity and that facts that he had submitted to the court and statements he'd made to court undermined those elements.
Okay, but you didn't specifically argue CCPA below.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, if we were to accept that argument on appeal, then why wouldn't he be entitled to an opportunity to replead in the lower court, and maybe he can comply with the CCPA, maybe he can't. But, I mean, how can we fairly judge that when he didn't have a chance to cure that defect below?
But the argument was made below that he failed to plead the claim appropriately. And so he certainly had an opportunity to request an opportunity to replead that cause of action. So that opportunity did exist because the same argument is being made. He has now changed the basis on appeal and indicated that this is now a cause of action under the CCPA, and so we have responded on appeal that he's also failed to plead under the CCPA. Moreover, the statements that he has made to the court below and here today undermine his being able to plead or demonstrate any of the elements, even as a CCPA claim. Principally, there's nothing that links U.S. Bank to making any sort of misrepresentation to Mr. Martin. The document in the record is an appraisal that was produced by an independent third party. You know, it is a representation as much to U.S. Bank as it is to Mr. Martin. And although this court has the requirement to view the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Martin, it's well settled Colorado law that this court need not close its eyes to conflicting and tortured statements. It's found Hewitt v. Rice, 119 P3rd, 541. And Mr. Martin's pleadings are the epitome of conflicting and tortured statements. He cannot have it both ways. He cannot, state to file a lengthy complaint with multiple exhibits and state throughout that complaint that he had that he couldn't believe the amount of the appraisal, that it was outrageous, that none of the houses in his neighborhood had ever sold for the amount, that he was shocked and amazed at the number, and then turn around and say that he has been somehow enticed by this document coming from a third party, and that it's U.S. Bank's fault for giving him money on a number based on a number that he himself didn't believe and thought was incredible. And his own statements to the court undermine his ability to even plead a cause of action under the CCPA.
Now, when you say his statements to the court, you're referring to allegations in his complaint?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Since we have to read the complaint in a manner most favorable to the pleader, couldn't those statements be read as reflective of his state of mind when the bank sought to foreclose rather than his state of mind at the time he took out the loan?
Mr. Martin, again, merely changes hats from going from district court to the appellate court. His argument now at the appellate level, and never made to the district court, is that, oh, no, wait, when I made those statements, I meant that I later found out. That's not what the statements say. His statements in several pleadings to the lower court are, I was shocked and amazed, was, past tense. I was shocked and amazed. I couldn't believe it. Past tense. I couldn't believe it. It's not I later found out and then came to not believe this outrageous appraisal. These are past tense statements. And his changing position and remodifying his words is simply what he's been doing at the district court level and what he did to my client with regard to the deed of trust. In this situation, he saw that the grantor was Rick Martin himself, the only individual with authority to encumber this property, and he did not make it that statement any more specific, and he signed the deed of trust as a competent, educated, licensed attorney in the state of Colorado.
Before your time's completely exhausted, let me ask a question dealing with your attorney fee claim. interpretation of 3840105B would be a question of first impression. There's a dispute as to whether the statute creates a cause of action or it's merely parasitic to the CCPA. Aren't those issues that even if Mr. Martin were to lose, they would still be colorable arguments precluding us from awarding fees against him?
No, I don't believe so.
Why not? I mean, it's a question of first impression.
I don't believe it's a question of first impression. The statute is very clear. The CCPA statute and 3840105 are very clear. 3840105 refers directly to the CCPA.
Is there anything in the CCPA that cross-references back to 3840?
Yes, sir.
And what section is that,
section
please?
Section 61105 sub UU. That's not W, it's UU. which references back, so the statute's cross-reference, it is very clear that violation of 3841.05 fulfills the first element of the five elements necessary to prove a CCPA claim, and the first element being that there is an unfair or deceptive trade practice. So the statutes are clear. He, being a licensed attorney, should have pled his complaint with particularity. Instead, he chose to plead lots of different actions and throw lots of phrases in there and hope that the district court would not sort them out. The district court did sort out his claims and found that no cause of action existed, or that they were countered by his own complaints. We would ask this court would uphold that decision and not allow Mr. Martin to continue to use judicial resources for these improper means. Thank you.
Both sides have exhausted their time. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. A written opinion will issue in due course.